Welcome, everybody. This is the Economics of the Great Depression class for the Mises Academy. This is Lecture 3, which I've called the Hoover Administration New Deal Light, and it's November 30th, 2012. Now, this particular lecture, you're definitely going to want to get the PowerPoint show and have that on your drive because I give you some data in here that isn't in the readings, the mandatory assigned readings. So there's some stuff in here that I think most of it or all of it comes from my depression book. So if you have that, you might not need this PowerPoint presentation, but clearly you want the, if you don't have that book, you want this. Okay, so as this outline shows, I'm actually going to catch up on some stuff from Lecture 2. So I'm going to try to go fast through this material, because I don't want to be behind again, so we're going to try to get caught up on this lecture. Let me just say, as much as you can, read Rothbard on this stuff, okay? Because he's, this was really innovative, path-breaking, pioneering work that Rothbard did to overturn the myth of the laissez-faire Herbert Hoover. So if you've got my book, I deal with some of it, but Rothbard was treating it as a historian, not as a, you know, somebody grabbing some cute factoids and spinning a little narrative the way I would. I mean, Rothbard really goes through and documents it. Okay, and also I'm saying that because in tonight's lecture, I'm going to have to be brief on some of these things because we have so much material. Okay, so Rothbard on the Fed during the 1920s, of course, he's going to say there was inflation. And let me just say this because I know some of you are new to these courses and you might not be that familiar with Austrian economics. For the Austrians, inflation has to do with the money stock, and that can include bank loans, as we'll see in a minute. And what I mean by that is certain measures of the money stock, when a commercial bank makes a loan, it increases that particular measure of the money stock, all right? So the banks are in the position of being able to create more money because of what's called fractional reserve banking. So when Rothbard or other Austrians talk about inflation, they typically mean inflating the quantity of money. And then, of course, that might have an impact on prices. So other things equal, if there's more money in the same amount of goods, you would expect the price quoted in money per good to go up. But there was a transformation during the 20th century where in the beginning, most people, the very term inflation, as economists used the term, meant inflating the money stock. Whereas nowadays, the general public and certainly, or economists and certainly the general public, when they talk about inflation, what they mean is, gee, why does everything keep getting more and more expensive? And so there was definitely that change in what the term meant, and a lot of Austrians are cynical and think that the reason for that transformation was sinister, that it was so that the public wouldn't be able to isolate the cause of rising prices. Because now if inflation means prices going up, and then you want to know why is that, you can blame labor unions, you can blame Arab oil exporting countries and so forth, greedy businesses, you don't look to the central bank. Whereas if inflation by definition means the quantity of money expanding, and then you want to wonder why are prices going up, you might say, well, it's because of inflation. And well, who controls inflation? Well, the Federal Reserve and the commercial banking system. All right, so what Rothbard is going to point out is that there was monetary inflation during the 1920s, even though there was relatively stable consumer price index. And that's not a contradiction. So what that means is if the Fed and the commercial banking system hadn't inflated the money stock, the quantity of money, then the increases in productivity, the increases in real output during the 20s would have manifested themselves by falling prices. So the fact that you see stable prices doesn't mean the Fed was doing its job. And remember, this goes back to the difference between the Austrians and Irving Fisher and the monetarists, what I talked about in the last lecture, that Irving Fisher's ideal was to stabilize the purchasing power of money. And there's various measures you could use, but Fisher thought the Fed was doing a great job because the purchasing power of money was fairly stable throughout the 1920s. And that's partly why in 1929 he was so optimistic and thought, yeah, the U.S. economy is in great shape here, because if you were a free market economist who had those views on money, like Fisher was, things would look great, right? Fiscal policy was beautiful, and the Fed was doing what you wanted it to do, so why wouldn't, and you had a bunch of prosperity already, why wouldn't that continue indefinitely? And that's why he issued those famous proclamations in late 1929, only a week or two before the stock market had its infamous crash. Okay, so very quickly, Austrian business cycle theory. Some people asked me before the course if I was going to review it. So there's plenty of material if you're not familiar with this. So in particular, at Mises.org, there's a reader that Richard Ebeling has. I think it's Austrian trade cycle theory. If anybody in the comments knows the exact title of this, but it's a collection of essays that Richard Ebeling assembled, and it has like an essay by Mises, one by Rothbard, one by Haveler, and some others, and that is a really good introduction to Austrian. I think they call it trade cycle theory in that title, but if somebody can tell me in the comments, I'll say it officially. So that's where I would go if you really don't know about Austrian business cycle theory. For our purposes right now, very quickly, the idea is it has to do with interest rates. That's the key thing. Okay? So other economists, so Cam has put it in the chat box there. The title is The Austrian Theory of the Trade Cycle and Other Essays. So that's a free document on Mises.org if you're a novice to this and you want to see the theory spell out. Also, in Rothbard's The Great Depression, America's Great Depression, which is the book for this course, I didn't officially assign that. But earlier in the volume, he goes through the basic abstract theory of how Austrians explain the business cycle. So you can look at it there also. Okay, so in a nutshell, what the theory says is that interest rates are market prices. They serve a definite coordinating function. So just like the price of apples means something, and the government can't just tinker with that price without screwing things up, by the same token, the interest rate in the market economy means something. If the interest rate in the market before the government and the Fed got involved were 8%, there's information, if you want, contained in that that communicates consumer preferences and available capital goods, stocks, and other resource supplies. And then the entrepreneurs take that information and use it in their plans. And it helps them decide whether to engage in longer term or shorter term projects. So other things equal, the lower the interest rate is, the more profitable a longer-term project will appear. And this has to do with the fact that if you're a business person and you're going to engage in a project, what happens? Well, you spend money up front, and then you also spend money to continue the operation, and at some point in the future, you're going to start receiving revenue from your customers based on the output that you're making, whether it's a service or a good. And so some projects involve large upfront expenditures and relatively distant payoffs, like the revenue doesn't start flowing in for a long time, whereas other projects there isn't much of a lag, and the initial expenditure isn't that great. So a high interest rate penalizes projects that have large upfront expenditures and that don't receive their revenues until a distant point in the future. So what that means is a lower interest rate doesn't simply cause more investment or induce more investment, right? So Keynesians and other types of schools of thought understand that the sense in which other things equal, you lower the interest rate, businesses are more likely to borrow and invest, and consumers are more likely to borrow on credit and spend, or they're less likely to save, they're going to consume more, the lower the interest rate is, other things equal. But the Austrians are the ones who really focus on the fact that it's not just that a lower interest rate triggers a greater volume of business investment, but the types of projects that in which businesses invest change. They become longer term oriented. So what happens in an unsustainable boom is the banking system, aided and abetted by the central bank in modern times, expands the quantity of money, but they do it through the credit markets. So the commercial banks lend more money into existence, and they do this with the help of the central bank and its encouragement. And so the only way they can do that, if we're initially at an equilibrium, and the interest rate's, let's say, 8%, and now the commercial banks create a bunch of new money out of thin air, and then they lend that, and they want to lend that into the market, well, they have to lower the interest rate in order to get businesses and individuals to expand their borrowings. Because if before you had an equilibrium, where in the loan market, quantity supplied equal quantity demanded, and now all of a sudden the banks want to lend out more, well, they got to lower the interest rate that they're charging. So necessarily, for the banks to lend out more funds than would exist if there were 100% reserve banking, if they couldn't create money out of thin air, the market rate that they charge is going to be less than what the market rate would be in the absence of credit expansion. And that's sometimes called the natural rate of interest. Okay, so the idea is during a credit expansion, the banks charge a market rate of interest that's lower than the so-called natural rate of interest. And this has consequences because, again, in the Austrian view, there's a very sophisticated understanding of the structure of production, and the economy is this engine or complex organism, if you will, that spans many years. So it's not simply a matter of, oh, spending went up this year because the interest rate went down. It's that, no, that the types of things that businesses purchased or invested in, starting long-term apartment building projects, things like that, as opposed to something more short-term, that changes the nature of the economy and what's getting cranked out. And so the structure of production evolves because of the low interest rates, and that's going to have consequences. All right, so I don't have time to get into it tonight, but the point is there are real changes that occur in the structure of production because of these false monetary or the monetary disturbances. So the Austrian theory of the boom-bust cycle, it's not purely a monetary theory, but it's also not a purely real theory. And that's why somebody like Paul Krugman got totally screwed up when he responded to me the one time he did so far. When he publicly responded to me, he thought he was dealing the Austrian theory of the business cycle a fatal blow when he pointed to empirical evidence that central banks can influence the economy. And then, of course, for those of us who are familiar with Austrian business cycle theory, that's hilarious. That he thought that was, you know, if it had been the other way, if the evidence showed that central banks couldn't influence the real economy, then we'd be in trouble. But Krugman thought, aha, you Austrians, you're idiots, because the empirical evidence shows central bank decisions can influence the boom-bust cycle. So, I mean, again, just, and he's confidently saying that we're nuts with that kind of criticism. But what he had in mind, the reason he said that, was because in his mind, the Austrians don't talk about aggregate demand, and so in his simplistic classification scheme, he said, well, gee, if they don't have a demand-based theory, they must be focusing on supply, and so they must be like a Chicago school real business cycle type theory of recessions, in which a recession has nothing to do with monetary forces. It's just there's technology shocks and supply shocks and other kinds of things. And so that what looks to us like a slowdown in the economy is actually the rational response of various actors in the economy to the new information. So in that sort of framework, monetary policy doesn't affect anything. And so that's what Krugman thought the Austrian theory was. So the Austrian theory isn't that. It's, again, to repeat, the Austrians say that, or the Austrian explanation of the boom-bust cycle, it's that there's monetary disturbances that then manifest themselves with real effects. So the monetary authority is responsible for the distortion, but then the problem can't merely be fixed by offsetting monetary policy, because once the distortion gets underway, there are real physical changes in the economy that you can't undo just by changing what you do with the printing press. All right, so the point is the unsustainable boom really is unsustainable physically. It's not that if they just kept expanding and kept the interest rate below the natural rate forever, you would have a perpetual boom. Eventually, people would abandon the currency, and then you'd see interest rates skyrocket, and you see the consequences of the unsustainable boom. One last thing that's different from the Austrian take versus just about everybody else, for the Austrians, it's the boom that's bad, and the bust or the depression is actually therapeutic. Because it's during the bust period when the banks stop inflating, let interest rates rise to their correct level, that now everyone's getting the right markets, the right price signals. And so that's why a lot of businesses stop and close and shut down, is because they should never have been in operation in the first place. They were only stimulated artificially by the low interest rate. And so it takes time for the economy to react to the correct information, and so certain workers have to get laid off, other resources have to get freed up so they can get reallocated to the right sectors. And that's what the recession or the bust phase is. That's why unemployment goes up. Because if you think about it, if what we're saying is during the boom period, workers and other resources were allocated improperly in an unsustainable fashion. They were all working on various projects, not all of which could be completed because there just wasn't enough physical savings to carry the economy through the completion of all these long-term projects. Well, how would you fix that? Even if you were an omniscient central planner and you saw this problem, so, oh my gosh, we have 3,001 different projects going on that are going to take 5 years to complete, but we're going to run out of food in 4 years. So what do we do? Well, clearly, you have to have some of those projects stop immediately. And maybe other ones, they don't stop completely, but they become less grandiose. You know, and other ones that are almost near completion, maybe you say, yeah, we never would have started this project had we known all along the situation, but given that the thing's 99% done at this point, rather than having a factory that's 99% finished and then just mothballing it, we'll go ahead and finish it because those costs are sunk. But even so, the thing was a bad investment, but it makes sense not to run it. Okay, all those things, if you imagine being a central planner and realized you had started a bunch of long-term projects that you didn't have enough resources to finish, you would make those kinds of decisions and make judgment calls about the individual projects and which ones to stop, which ones to continue, which ones to continue at half capacity, and so forth. So if you think about it, that's exactly what happens in a market economy when there's a recession. All right, so it's not fun if you're a worker who happens to be in an industry that shuts down immediately, but that's what has to happen. And the point, the Austrian point is, if you don't like that, then don't start unsustainable boons by pushing down interest rates. Okay, a little digression here on life insurance, because don't worry, I'm not trying to sell you life insurance, but this is something that's in Rothbard's treatment. So the big picture here is Rothbard's definition of money. Because again, what Rothbard wants to argue here is that during the 1920s, the Federal Reserve and the commercial banking system, and some other institutions, including insurance companies, expanded the quantity of money, that there was inflation in the monetary sense, and that meant interest rates were artificially low. So even though the official price measures didn't show any signs of overheating the way the Keynesians would describe it, nonetheless, there was genuine monetary inflation, and therefore interest rates were too low, and that set up the unsustainable boom, so we shouldn't be surprised that the economy crashed in 1929. That's the idea. So Rothbard's definition is that money is not just gold and not even just Federal Reserve notes that were legally redeemable for gold, but also things like bank deposits, checking account deposits. Would also be included in this broader concept of money. All right, so if you're familiar with the work of Mises, Mises distinguished between money in the narrower sense and money in the broader sense. So money is just the commonly accepted medium of exchange. So historically, in modern times, it was the precious metals, gold and silver. That was the market's commodity money. And then governments pegged their currencies to them. But beyond that, so that would be money in a narrower sense, the actual commodity money. But then if you had claims that were immediately redeemable and there was no question of their redeemability, then Mises called those things money substitutes. I'm not going to quiz you on this stuff, so don't freak out. I'm just trying to give you the context here so you understand what's going on. All right, so a money substitute is not the money in the narrower sense. It's just something that under normal circumstances can function as a substitute for money. So the best example of that would be checking account deposits with a reputable bank. So here, you know, if you go into the store and they accept checks and something costs $100 so that you could pay for it with a $100 bill, you know, that had Benjamin Franklin on it, or if you go to write a check, the owner of the store is not going to say to you, oh, well, if you pay me with a check, it's $108. But if you pay me with cash, it's only $100. That typically doesn't happen. Some places it actually would, because but that's for tax purposes. It's not because he's afraid that your bank's going to default. It's because if you pay with check, then he has to report it to the IRS, or he's more likely to have to report it. Okay, but the point is, for most places, checking account balances are accepted at par with the actual money. And so they're considered money substitutes. So that's why if you're trying to quantify money in the broader sense, you wouldn't just count the actual currency that the public holds, but you'd also include commercial checking account balances, what people think they have in their checking account. All right? So Rothbard says, well, if we're going to use those criteria to determine what money is, and that's why we would include checking account balances as well as actual currency or gold coins, if we're back in the days of when gold was money, then we also have to include the cash value of life insurance in our definition of money in the broader sense. So let me just very quickly in this slide explain to you what that is, because I'm sure some of you don't know. All right, the first, I'm assuming you all know what life insurance is, that you pay premiums to an insurance company, and then if you die, they send you a check, or they send your estate a check. Okay, just like if you have fire insurance and your house catches on fire, you get a check. Okay, but there's a distinction with life insurance that doesn't show up with other types of insurance, this distinction of term versus permanent. So term insurance is like pure insurance. So that's analogous to fire insurance on your house. So with term life insurance, I could have a 20-year term policy for $1 million. And so there, the insurance company gives me a physical, they look at my medical history, blah, blah, blah. And then they say, okay, you want $1 million. They look at my income and stuff and make sure I earn enough so that it's not going to be worthwhile for my son to kill me and get the insurance money. And assuming that stuff all checks out, they say, okay. And then they charge me a premium, either monthly or annual, whatever. And so I give that to them. And if I die at any point in those 20 years, then they send a $1 million check to whoever I name as my beneficiary. But if I stop making the payments, then of course the contract collapses. Or if I go the full 20 years making those payments diligently, and the 20 years is up, that's it. They don't owe me any money. We go our separate ways, and all those premiums I pay to them are just gone to me. Permanent insurance, on the other hand, doesn't expire. As long as I keep making my payments, they're eventually going to pay me. So the way that might work, for example, is I might have what's called the whole life insurance policy. And so here we say, okay, I'm going to pay you premiums every month. If I die, you send my beneficiary $1 million. If I live to reach the age of 121, then the policy completes, and then the insurance company send me a check for $1 million. So the point is, as long as I keep making those premium payments, I know I'm getting $1 million from the insurance company. It's just a matter of timing. If I happen to die before age 121 or whatever it is, I get it then. Or if I live to be 121, then the policy completes that way and I get the check. So here now, the insurance company's in a different position. They know that they may have to pay me. Like, as long as I keep making those payments, the premium payments, they're going to have to pay me. So it's not merely pure insurance. There's also an equity aspect. So it's kind of like the difference between renting an apartment versus taking a mortgage out from a bank and buying a house. And then with every mortgage payment, you reduce how much you owe on the house, and so you gain more and more equity. So after the 30 years is up, if it's a 30-year mortgage, you own the house. Whereas if you were just living in a house that a landlord owned and just making monthly rental payments, it's not like after you lived there for 30 years, you would own the building. It would still be the landlord's building. You wouldn't have gained any equity, and all those rental payments, you know, would be gone to you. Okay, so that's a good analogy for term versus permanent insurance, life insurance. Okay, so with permanent insurance, the premiums are higher. Just like if you buy a house, the mortgage payment you make every month is going to be higher than what you would have to pay to a landlord to live in a similar house, but you're not gaining equity in it. Okay? So with those higher premiums that you're paying to the insurance company, if it's a permanent insurance policy, effectively, and they do this in terms of the accounting, they take some of that and buy just the pure term insurance in case you happen to die that year. So in other words, they figure out, if you just had a one-year term policy, what would we charge you? And then out of your big whole life premium, they sort of earmark some of that on their books for the pure insurance aspect. And then with the remainder, they go and invest that in mutual funds or whatever they buy. And because they need to have this growing stockpile of assets, because they know if this guy lives to be 120, then we have to give him $1 million or whatever the death benefit is, the face value of the policy. So they have to have this thing growing such that by the time you hit 121, even if you haven't died, now they've got $1 million of assets to hand over to you. So if you think through that, well, then, you know, what if you're 30, you take out a whole life policy, you're paying the premiums diligently for 50 years, and they've got this huge growing pile of assets on their books earmarked for you, but then you run into liquidity trouble when you're 80. Well, it would be a shame if you had nothing to show for it and you couldn't keep making your insurance payments anymore, and then you just lost all that, and then they got to keep the huge stockpile of assets. So what they have is a surrender clause where they say, with a permanent life insurance policy, if you want, you can just cancel the policy, terminate it, and then, you know, you stop making your premium payments. We, the insurance company, are no longer on the hook for paying you if you die, but we'll give you the assets that we've been accumulating on your behalf. All right, and there's typically like a penalty there because they don't want you to do that. They want you to stay in the policy. All right, and those values are all spelled out in the original contract. So it's called the guaranteed surrender cash value. So you know when you're age 30, you sign this thing, you can look at this long-term schedule and see, if I surrender when I'm 45, this is how much they promise to give to me. If I surrender when I'm 50, this is how much they promise to give to me, and so forth. And then if I happen to live to make it to 121, they're guaranteeing they're going to give me $1 million. That's the idea. Okay? So that's what Rothbard's talking about with the cash value of life insurance. Oh, there's one other thing. You can borrow against it. All right, so the other thing you might be thinking of is, geez, well, okay, so if I'm 80 years old and I get into a little of a short-term cash flow problem, I could just terminate the whole policy and then get whatever the cash value is at that moment. But what if I really like this insurance policy? It's just I'm a little bit short on cash and I can't make the premium payment for a few months. You're telling me I got to give up this policy that I've been building for 50 years? That's crazy. So the insurance company will say, oh, well, you know, we'll make a loan to you, and we'll use this underlying cash value as the collateral on the loan. So the insurance company is making a side loan to you with the underlying surrender cash value serving as the collateral, and so you get it at a better interest rate than if you just went out and got an unsecured loan. So it's not risky to the insurance company, because even if you never pay them back, what happens is, when they go to pay you a benefit claim, they just pay themselves back the loan. So let's say you're 80, you take a loan from them of $10,000. Let's say your cash value at that point had been $60,000. So they say, well, we're willing to lend you up to $60,000. And you say, I just need 10. And I say, okay, we're going to charge you 8% interest. You say, okay, that's fine. So then they give you a check for $10,000. They don't need to check your credit score. They don't care if you have a job the way a bank would, even if you were going to get a home equity loan. Insurance company doesn't care because that loan is perfectly safe. That's, for them, that's safer than lending to Uncle Sam, because there's a chance the government could default on treasuries. It's impossible for you to default, because even if you never send them a single penny, they just have that loan on their books rolling over at 8%, growing, and your cash value is growing too, because you keep making your premium payments, and they just make sure they don't lend you enough such that they never get caught, so that you owe them more money than they could possibly owe you, given the terms of the insurance contract. They're always going to be in a position where if you terminate, you know, of the big cash value they were supposed to give you, they'll have enough to pay themselves the loan. Or if you die, the death benefit will be bigger than what you owe them, so they'll just, you know, pay themselves back and then send the balance to your widow or whoever your beneficiary is. Or if you live to be 121, and then they owe you the face value, but you still have a loan on the books, they'll pay themselves off and then send you the balance. Okay, so that's why it's completely safe from their point of view. They just don't know when you're going to pay them back. Okay, so now that you understand how this works, you can see why Rothbard is arguing that cash surrender values on life insurance policies should be included in the definition of money in the broader sense, because of the fact that if you understand what the definition, what the criteria were, excuse me, of how does something get to be in money in the broader sense, Rothbard saying, why wouldn't cash value of life insurance stay? Because even though, strictly speaking, legally, the insurance companies have the right to tell you, if you call them up and say, hey, I want to close my policy down, give me the cash surrender value, contractually, they might be able to tell you, we'll get back to you in 3 months. Even so, in practice, people expect it to be payable on demand. And Mises has a discussion of that whenever he talks about these things, that that's really what's important. Economically, do people think these are demand deposits, that they can call them upon request, whether or not legally that's required? If in practice people treat these things as if they're instantly accessible, then it's part of, and if they're redeemable at par. That's the other thing, so let me stress that. You might say, now that you're understanding this, you might say, well, wait a minute, why wouldn't my holdings of Google stock count as part of the money supply? That, you know, right now I think I have $10,000 worth of stock, and so are you telling me that I should count not only the $100 bills in my wallet, what I think my bank balance is, my checking account balance, what my latest statement from the insurance company says my surrender cash value is, and I get a letter from my broker saying right now I have $10,000 in my account because of my Google stock, so why wouldn't the $10,000 be included? The reason is what you actually own with your stock, the asset is the shares of stock, okay? What you have there is, whatever, 1,000 shares of the stock that right now have a market price of 10. Nobody is guaranteeing to you that upon request they will give you $10,000. What you actually own are the 1,000 shares of stock, which right now happen to have a market price of $10 a piece. So that's why they're not in the money. So whereas the life insurance, what the insurance company owes you is denominated in dollars. Right. Now you might say, well, okay, what about a corporate bond? That's an asset that's denominated in the currency, so in the United States, denominated in dollars. So how come that's not part of the money stock? Because that's not instantly redeemable. Right? If I buy a bond from a corporation, meaning I lend them money, so let's say I give them $1,000 today, and I buy a one-year bond from them at 10%. So what they're saying is, this document entitles you to get $1,100 from us 1 year from now. That's not part of the money stock because it's not instantly redeemable. I can go and sell that on the open market, but I'm not guaranteed a price for it. It depends what interest rates have done in the meantime. To get the $1,100 that thing contractually promises me, I have to wait the year. So that's not instantly redeemable the way checking account balances are, and the way my current life insurance surrender value is. Okay, so that's why I'm talking you through this, trying to get you to understand the judgment calls you would make and why Rothbard is saying the cash value of life insurance should be included in the money stock, but he wouldn't say the value of all corporate bonds or something like that, or he certainly wouldn't say that as the Dow Jones Industrial Average goes up, that means the money stock is increasing. Okay, so ...1920s monetary inflation. So I'm basing this off of the table that's in Rothbard's book. I just condensed it. I left out a lot of the categories and so forth. So he's looking at these two, this start and end date. And why is he picking June of 1921? Well, I think he says something like that's when most people agree that the boom began. Remember, there was the depression of 1920 to 21, so the Fed had been very contractionary. Remember, I showed you those charts of what was happening even with the monetary base, and I told you with interest rates, the Fed had jacked up its discount rate, or at least the New York Federal Reserve, its discount rate, it had jacked up to an all-time high. The monetary base crashed because they were trying to get the wartime price inflation under control. So the Fed deliberately tightened in 20 and 21, and so Rothbard is saying, you know, by June of 1921, we're through that tightening, and now the Fed was inflating again. And so that's why he's picking that as the starting point. All right, so then these categories, you can see the various things. So these are each a component in the total money supply, and I'm leaving some stuff out. So there's other things. In other words, just adding these numbers up isn't going to add up to this. There's other stuff that I haven't included. Okay, one last thing is the numbers in this column that I'm putting for you here are different from the numbers you're going to see in Rothbard's table and that he discusses in the text. My numbers here are lower than Rothbard's, and here's why. I'm doing the annualized percent change, whereas Rothbard is just doing the average annual percent change. And so the difference has to do with exponential growth. Right? So it's, if something grows, if something grows 100% over 10 years, the annual percent growth is 10%, right? Because 100 divided by 10 is 10. But actually, that doesn't mean the thing grew at 10% per year because of exponential growth or compound interest, if you will. Right? If it grew 10% the first year and then from that point grows another 10%, well, that's, that new number now is more than 20% bigger than the first number, right? Because you're doing the 10% of the 10%. So that's why my figures are actually lower than Rothbard's, because I'm doing it saying, what would be the annual percentage increase such that if you did this for all those years in a row, 21, you know, to 22, to 23, to 24, up to 29, then multiplying those all together would give you what we know is the cumulative percentage increase. Okay, so that's that. So you can see the last thing I'll point out here is you can see why some people were critical of Rothbard for including the insurance policy reserves. By the way, one last little technical point. Oops. This thing here, insurance policy reserves, historically speaking, that's not the same thing as cash values. Insurance policy reserves are something that accountants, when they're dealing with insurance companies, that's an official thing to report. So we have data on that. It's not worth, for our purposes, getting into it. But I just want to point out, it's not exactly the same thing as surrender cash values. It's a proxy for it. So we'd have reason to think the two would be close. And I think Rothbard even talks about that in the text, saying, I can't show you. I don't have data on what actual insurance policy cash surrender values were for all of their customers, but what we do have is this. And so that's fine. That's not going to be a big difference. However, what is possibly relevant is that, notice, the biggest increase in terms of these categories is the insurance policy reserves. And I'm almost positive it's not just the ones I'm showing here, but of all the things Rothbard includes to get this total money supply figure, I think the insurance policy reserves were the ones that grew the most during the 1920s. So some people have criticized Rothbard, saying, oh, come on, nobody nowadays, when they talk about the money stock, thinks of putting cash or insurance surrender values into it. The only reason you did that is because you ran the numbers and saw that it grew fast, and so you knew that would bump up this number. You know, you wanted to include something in the total that grew faster than the other constituents because you wanted to make the total as big as possible because your whole thesis is the Fed's inflation caused the 1920s boom and bust. And so that, so you needed the number to be as big as possible. That's why you included that in there. So that's the allegation. One defense of that is to say, look, Rothbard, you know, he didn't just arbitrarily grab that thing. He told you what the criteria were for money in the broader sense, and insurance policy reserves fit. So, you know, that's not his fault that the thing fits the definition. Another thing to point out is back then, insurance policies really were a vehicle for long-term savings for the average person, the average household, more so than today. Okay, because one thing that happened is with the high price inflation and interest rates of the late 1970s, life insurance got a bad reputation as being a vehicle for savings, and especially then with the introduction of low-fee mutual funds so that like the small guy could now invest in the S&P 500 and so forth, that now made people less willing to plan for their retirement by buying life insurance. But historically, that wasn't unusual at all. So what this, if this is all new to you, open up Mises Human Action, the PDF, so you can search it, and just search for the term life insurance. And you'll see that Mises, in a few places in Human Action, talks, you know, as matter-of-factly about how households save via life insurance. Then the other thing is the movie It's a Wonderful Life. In the beginning of that, when Jimmy Stewart's character gets into financial trouble, the first thing he does is he goes to the, you know, the local greedy banker or whatever, and he hands over his life insurance policy to the guy. The guy looks at it. And, you know, and he's saying, oh, this is what I got. So the point is, this for Rothbard to say in the 1920s, life insurance was an important component of what people would have thought of as their readily accessible cash, that's not crazy for him to say that. The other point that Joe Salerno makes is whether you include life insurance reserves or not, it doesn't change the total figure all that much. So yeah, the rate of increase is big, but there, as far as it skewing the average, I mean, it wasn't that much. That wasn't that big compared to the whole thing anyway. Okay. I'm just trying to spare the timing. Okay. So Lionel Robbins said, this is from his book on the Depression. It's a really interesting book, by the way. So I would encourage, if you're really interested in this stuff and you like history, I would encourage you to read Robbins, because it's fun sometimes to read economists that aren't strictly Austrians, and especially economists writing a long time ago. It's just, it's interesting to get that different perspective and how they look at the world and the sort of tools they used, just to give more nuance to things. And so you can understand the Austrian approach better by reading people that are near it, so to speak. Okay. So anyway, Lionel Robbins said, I think, when did he do this? I want to say this was in 1934. If somebody can correct me. I'm not going to look it up right now, but my question is, when did Lionel Robbins write this book? I think it came out in 34. It was in the early 30s. But anyway, so he's saying, first he sets up the context saying, historically, under classical central banking doctrine, the point was not to bail out insolvent firms. That was not what central banks thought their mission was when there was a depression with a small d, or a panic. That what they were supposed to do was allocate capital or to ensure liquidity, which is not the same thing as solvency. All right, and I'll talk a little bit about that distinction more in the next slide. But anyway, here's the quote what Robin says. So after he set that up, now he's talking in the early 1930s and says, in the present depression, we have changed all that. We eschew the sharp purge. We prefer the lingering disease. Everywhere, the efforts of central banks and governments have been directed to propping up bad business positions. All right, so when we're trying to understand what was it about the 1930s that made it the worst calamity in modern economic history, the Keynesians and the monetarists both say, oh, it's because they were too timid. They did things just like their predecessors did, whereas now we know the importance of counter-cyclical policy. If only the Fed had inflated more, if only the governments had run bigger budget deficits. So I've already pointed out why that doesn't make sense on the face of it. If you're saying the reason the 1930s was the worst depression in history is that they didn't behave enough like we do in modern times, well, then how come the Great Depression in world history didn't occur earlier? You know what I'm saying? So in other words, they're kind of saying in the 1800s, central banks, if they even existed, and the governments were very laissez-faire. In the 30s, they were just very weakly counter-cyclical. And then, thank goodness, after World War II, we had the modern technocrats who understand economics. So if that's the way things are, you would expect the worst depressions ever to have been in the 1800s. You would have expected the 1930s crash to be moderate. And then you would have expected relatively light crashes after World War II, when in fact the two worst crashes and depressions happened in the 30s and then in the modern era when central bankers are supposed to be geniuses. All right. But beyond that, I'm saying that's why I love this quote from Robbins, why I'm giving it to you guys here and why I put it in my book, is – you know, this makes sense. What if things changed? What if there was a fundamental qualitative difference in how governments and central banks responded to the initial crash? Then that would make sense. If I'm trying to explain why was it that the 1930s were the most agonizing recovery in history up to that point, what if I told you that, just as a matter of record, central banks and governments responded differently to this crash than they had to any previous one? Now things start to make sense. That's at least plausible. That maybe, you know, maybe that could explain it. You'd still want to come up with a compelling economic theory, but the point is, in terms of what changed to make the changed outcome, well, it makes sense to say they did things differently. It doesn't make sense to say they were too much like they had always done it, and that's why we got this radical change in outcome. That makes no sense. So that's why I love this Robbins quote, because he's saying here, as you know, man on the ground, that things are different. This isn't how we used to combat these things. So what is he talking about now? When Robbins is referring to classical central bank doctrine, one of the things he probably has in mind is Walter Badgett's famous dictum. So this is from the 19th century, and a lot of people took this to summarize, to crystallize what it was that central banks were supposed to do during a crisis, a financial panic, if you will. He said that the central bank should lend freely at a high rate on good collateral. So what's funny is a lot of commentators in 2009 in particular, when the Fed started doing all of its quantitative easing, a lot of them were citing Badgett and saying, yep, Badgett told us that's what the central bank's supposed to do. That's why we have central banks, and we're not vulnerable to the wild up and downs of the free market credit system. We've got the good old central bank there to step in as a lender of last resort. And that's just what Walter Badgett said. He said, in the panic, the central bank should lend freely, period. And they said, no, his actual quotation was, lend freely at a high rate, or what some people call a penalty rate, on good collateral. And this, so what this has to do with is the difference between liquidity and solvency. So what Robbins was talking about to set up what classical central banking doctrine was or had been, he was saying that in a panic, when there's a liquidity crisis, when everybody panics and they're hoarding money, there can be business enterprises that are actually sound. They're solvent. It's just they're illiquid. Right? So to be solvent means they're not bankrupt. Their assets are worth more than their liabilities. It makes sense for them to continue an operation. It would be wasteful for them to shut down. It's just, ooh, they happen to owe some people some money right now, and they don't have any money coming in. But it, you know, over a long-term horizon, the present market value of all their incoming receipts is higher than their obligations to others, right? So their assets are more than their liabilities. It's just right now they have a short-term cash flow problem. Because of, you know, the frozen credit market, they can't just go out and borrow and pay the people that they owe right now and then pay off those, you know, roll those loans over and pay them off, because they're not, over the long term, it's all going to work out because they're solvent. They got more coming in than going out in present value terms. But they had this liquidity crunch. So Badgett said, in that kind of environment, what you want is the central bank to come in and lend freely, lend to anybody who wants, but you charge a high penalty rate. The interest rate you charge on those freely given loans is high, and you insist on seeing good collateral. Because the point is, you want to separate the genuinely sound businesses from the ones that really ought to go bankrupt. You want the insolvent enterprises to shut down. And so that's why the central bank has a high rate and insists on good collateral. So the high rate is one obstacle to ensure that the people coming to your window to borrow actually are serious. In other words, if you're a sound enterprise and you know this is just a temporary cash crunch, liquidity crisis, you're willing to pay 15% on a loan because you know you're going to pay it off quickly. It's just you got to get through this crisis. But if you really know that, no, the game is up, I can't stay in business, I never should have started this thing, and then you're thinking about maybe letting it go for another 2 or 3 months to see if it turns around, and then someone comes along and says, I'll lend you money at 15%, you're just, well, no, I'm not gonna go even deeper into debt when this is hopeless anyway. You're just going to shut it down. And also the good collateral, that weeds out the people who are just crazy or, you know, liars. They just come up to you and say, yeah, I'll borrow your money, or they're just, you know, trying for a home run. They're delusional, and they just think any day now my business is going to take off, even though it's a crazy business model. So the central bank's not just going to lend money to anybody who says, oh, yeah, I'll pay you 15% when they don't have a chance of paying you back. That's why you insist on good collateral for the loan. All right, so this is not at all what Bernanke has done. Bernanke intentionally overpaid for assets. In other words, he intentionally bought so-called toxic assets and let the banks and other institutions unload things like mortgage-backed securities in exchange for treasuries, which no one in their right mind would have done in the private sector. All right, so that's not at all what Walter Badgett was saying. He wasn't trying to bail out firms. He was just trying to genuinely provide liquidity. So as Austrians, we can argue with that and say you don't need a central bank to do that. But the point is, classical central banker doctrine, as crystallized in Walter Badgett's dictum, was not at all consistent with what they were doing in the 30s. Well, that's controversial. Certainly, it's not consistent with what happened since 2008. Now, we're not going to get into it now because I got to move on. But just so you guys know, on my blog, I posted this, or not this, I posted this quote from Robbins, and I said, hey, those of you who are knowledgeable about this stuff, do you agree with Lionel Robbins? In other words, should we just take his word for it that actually central banks really had changed their philosophy And the answer I got back, I'm not going to summarize the evidence, but from people who seemed like they knew what they were talking about, and the guy pointed to this guy, J.P. Koenig, was one guy and some others, it looked like, for sure, what central banks had done, or the Fed at least, in the 1920s and 30s was qualitatively different from how central banks had done things before World War One. But it wasn't as obvious that, like, let's say the New York Fed, it wasn't as obvious that it responded differently after the 29 crash from how it had responded earlier in the 20s. Because there were short-term downturns in the U.S. economy throughout the 20s, and then the Fed would just inflate to get through those. And that's actually why Milton Friedman thought if only the Fed had inflated in 28 and 29, we would have been fine, just like it had done earlier. But because Benjamin Strong died and we had a bunch of morons at the wheel and there was political infighting, blah, 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 the Fed stood back and did nothing in 28 and 29, and that's why the bottom fell out. All right, so anyway. Okay, this slide, U.S. unemployment rate, pretty self-explanatory. I realized going through this slideshow today that you guys might not have known this. So just so you can see, these are the official numbers as the U.S. government put them out. So you can see in the United States, the you probably can't see that circle I just drew, but it topped out in 1933 at 25%. And then it dropped sharply, then jumped up sharply again, going from 1937 to 38, and then it fell way down. So we're going to see in the coming weeks how we deal with the Keynesian and monetarist interpretations, as in particular the people who say, oh, see, World War II clearly got us out of the Great Depression because look at that, what finally cured unemployment. We'll look at that claim. Okay. Hoover versus FDR. Just giving you some examples of ways that they were very similar. And again, to get the full brunt of this, go read Rothbard's treatment. And he's got a 1-2 punch that you've got a bunch of just facts and statistics, but you've also got plenty of quotations from Hoover himself, speeches he gave, things he wrote in his memoirs. All right, so Herbert Hoover did not at all view himself as a laissez-faire guy. And it's not even, because you got to be cynical about this stuff. Just because Herbert Hoover in his memoirs written years later, just because there he claims he was willing to use the power of the federal government to help people, and that just events were beyond his control, blah, 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 that by itself wouldn't clinch it, because it's possible that when he was in office, he had been a laissez-faire guy. It didn't work. Things were awful. Everybody blamed him for the Great Depression, and so then later he tried to rewrite history and say, no, I was a good guy, right? So that's possible, but that's why it's important not just to take his word for it when he says he did all kinds of stuff at the federal level to help people, to help get through the Depression, but also, like I said, you've got the documented history that can just look at the statistics and the various legislation, and Rothbard shows you stuff going back to Hoover's days under Harding. All right, so from the early 1920s on, Herbert Hoover was an interventionist, and Rothbard documents in particular how Hoover bought into what was called the New Economics. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a couple minutes. All right, so, again, it's not that Herbert Hoover was a Marxist or something, but the point is this claim that he was a small government laissez-faire guy is just crazy. In fact, there's some great quotes, some of which are in my Depression book, if you've got that, but FDR in the 32 campaign was castigating Herbert Hoover as a reckless big spender. And Roosevelt promised the American people, well, I don't know if Roosevelt did, but the Democratic platform for the 32 election called for a balanced budget. I don't know if FDR in his stump speeches said I'm going to give you a balanced budget. But he, there are quotes of him saying things like, you know, looking at the Hoover administration, I have never seen in throughout the history of the United States such reckless expenditure of the public's money. Something like, you know, that's not an exact quote, but he has quotes to that effect. All right, so that's interesting that if actually the thing with Herbert Hoover was that he was a penny-pinching, laissez-faire, small-government guy who was an austerian, as Paul Krugman would say, it's interesting that while he was, you know, doing all these austere policies of contraction and watching the federal budget and the economy imploded, that FDR would run against him, calling him the most reckless spender in U.S. peacetime history. Wouldn't that be an odd thing to say? Wouldn't FDR instead say, how come this guy's not willing to spend any money to help you guys? See what I mean? Just another example of public works. There's a famous dam that's named Hoover. And unfortunately, the history there is a bit nuanced. It's not entirely correct to say Herbert Hoover, because of the Great Depression, said, hey, let's spend a bunch of money. I know, let's build a dam and name it after me. That the dam had been on the drawing board for a while. And so, you know, so it's, so you got to be a little bit careful about that, but still, it is fun to say. It's funny that this laissez-faire guy that was unwilling to spend money has a dam named after him. Okay, I'm going to speed up here in the interest of time. This is give you some idea of the spending record of the Hoover administration. Let me just look up something really fast here. If you go to Herbert Hoover, like on Wikipedia, you'll see that it says he's in office March 4th, 1929 to March 4th, 1933. And that's, you got to keep that in mind for understanding these spending records. So these are fiscal years. So there's, when you're trying to figure out which president goes with which spending record, there's two adjustments you got to make. So the first thing is, so I say back then, there's two things that are different compared to now, in case you're used to working with more recent stuff. So the federal fiscal year ran from started July 1st, whereas now it starts October 1st. All right, so that's one difference. And then the other difference is that inauguration then was in March, and now it's in January. All right, so the election, when Hoover was elected, was in November of 1928. So Hoover was not inaugurated until March of 1929. And then the federal fiscal years, and so that's, you know, like if you look up in data about U.S. government spending and taxes and so forth, probably it's listed as fiscal years. So if you look and say, oh, what was federal spending in 1929? Probably what they mean is this right here. That would be fiscal 1929, which actually shows how much the federal government spent from July of 28 through the end of June 29. So Herbert Hoover would only have been in office, you know, March, April, May, June, at best 4 months for this. And then when you take into account that, you know, they had to pass legislation, he's got to sign it, you see what I'm saying? So that's why really the most you would want to say is that this is where Hoover could possibly be held to be responsible. And then again, depending on how the political realities were, some people go so far as to not count it until this one. So I think that's a bit extreme. But the point is, when you want to look at which fiscal years belong with which presidents, make sure you're aware of those two adjustments for this period. Anyway, you can see clearly after the stock market crash, Hoover's increasing spending. And that's quite significant because tax receipts were falling and the dollar was strengthening. So it's not just this pretty big increase in percentage terms. It's that this was happening while tax receipts were plummeting and while the dollar was strengthening in general. So this is very, those are incredibly significant spending hikes. And perhaps a better way of showing it is look what happened to the surplus or deficit as a share of GDP. So again, is this what a laissez-faire austerian does? Does it make sense to say, oh, the reason that the 1929 crash ushered in the Great Depression was that Herbert Hoover was a penny-pinching balanced budget guy? That doesn't make any sense. And this was certainly not the method of prior administrations. And there's good quotes that Rothbard has from Hoover saying just that. In his memoirs, Hoover says, we could have done nothing, but instead we met this with the most urgent counterattack ever conceived of during peacetime, or something like that. Okay, hang on, let me zoom ahead. I want to see how much time I got. Okay. Now, you got to be careful. Guys like Krugman and Christina Romer, Christina Romer's a woman, not a guy, they're going to blame austerity, the desire to balance the budget, for the severity of the Great Depression. So it's true, if you go back to that unemployment slide, you can see that it was steadily increasing, but I mean, by 32 and 33, it was really awful. It just kept getting worse and worse. It was not bottoming out. So the way they explain that, as they say, and in some of their expositions, it's incredibly slippery. You would have no idea, reading some of Krugman and Christina Romer's discussion of this period, that the deficit had done that. You would think from reading their discussion that the budget had been balanced, or that Hoover had kept spending the same and it was only falling tax receipts that led to the deficit, and then because Hoover wanted to have a balanced budget, then he cut spending and raised taxes. That's the impression you would get from reading them. When you can see that, no, that's not at all what's going on. He increased spending. Okay, so, but it is true that there was a tax hike and a spending and spending reductions to try to rein in the budget deficit in 1932. In my book, I go through in more painstaking detail the breakdown. You can see that there was a huge emphasis given to the tax hikes and only a very modest cut in spending. All right, but the Keynesians argue that, oh, see, the move to austerity, because Hoover's advisors were telling him, sir, we can't keep running up the debt like this. We got to do something, and that's what plunged us in the depths of the Great Depression. That's the narrative the Keynesians give. So let me just show you how incredibly onerous this tax hike was. Rothbard goes through and shows that it wasn't just a bumping up of the rates, but also they just started taxing stuff that had never been taxed before, right? So, I mean, it was crazy. But here, let's just look at federal income taxes levied on individuals. I think these are the rates for married couples filing jointly. So 1931, these are the rates after, you know, this is what had happened. I showed you in lecture one after Calvin Coolidge, well, first Harding and then Coolidge and the advice of Andrew Mellon had brought down rates that had been very high at the end of World War I, such that in 1931, the top marginal income tax rate was 25%, and that was levied on any income $100,000 and above. So then in 32, look at the new tax schedule. Now, these are only select brackets, meaning I'm not showing you every little thing. The 1932 schedule has like 20 brackets. All right, so I'm showing you the lower ones, and then some ones from the middle, and then I'm showing you the top in both cases. So just look at if you were in the lowest tax bracket. So in 31, if you made between zero and just under 4,000, you got taxed at 1.5%. That same bracket, 1 year later, the rate jumped to 4. Okay, so that's more than a doubling of the rate on the lowest taxpayers or lowest income payers. Right, that's, if you're not familiar with tax policy, that might not seem like a big deal to you, but that's incredible. I mean, to have rates go up that much is almost unheard of, all right? You can see this one went from 3% to 8%. Again, so more than doubling of the rate. And also notice the brackets are getting narrower. So here, originally it was 4,000 to just under 8,000, but now it's 4,000 to just under 6,000. All right, and then you can look at the other ones. And then the most shocking thing, perhaps, is the top rate in 1931 was 25%. The next year, the top rate, now it only kicked in on incomes above a million, was 63%. So in 1 year, and again, this, they didn't do this in 1927 when times were good. They did this in 1932 when we were already had unemployment that was, you know, well into the double digits. That's when they decided, you know, how about we take the top income tax rate that's right now 25%, let's raise it to 63%. They did that in 1 year. I mean, right now, people are freaking out about the top rate going from 35% to 39.6. And there's other, you know, Medicare tax on investment stuff. But that's the basic pure federal income tax rate. It might go from 35% to 39.6 unless Congress intervenes. And that's what people are calling the fiscal cliff. Here it went from 25% to 63%. That's just shocking. And if you think about it in terms of the incentives to produce, what that means is originally if you made, like, so for people who made above $1 million a year, in 31, you got to keep 75 cents on the dollar of that marginal dollar. The next year, you only got to keep 37 cents. So the amount you got to keep was more than cut in half, or was cut by more than half. All right, so it's not really that you want to look at the percentage increase of the rate. You want to look at how much do you get to keep of what you nominally earn. So when you're trying to understand why do things get so awful, I mean, this surely has something to do with it if you think there's any connection at all between what people are allowed to keep and how much they're willing to work or how much income they want to generate. Okay, another major thing that I think is instrumental in explaining the high unemployment of the early 1930s was the high wage policy. So Rothbard goes through and explains it more carefully. What happened is after the 29 stock market crash, Hoover calls in all the big business leaders and he tells them, I don't want you to cut wages. That's traditionally what businesses do. They're all looking out for numero uno. They all look out for their narrow self-interest. And so when revenues fall because customers are spooked, and, you know, so the profits are falling, businesses normally lay people off and or cut wages. He said that's what people, businesses have always done historically. That's what capitalism gives you. And so Hoover bought into this new economics, and he thought that's what causes a downward spiral in the economy. Let's nip that in the bud. Because what happens is, Hoover thought, relying on some economists who had argued this way, Hoover thought that, there's a downturn, people stop spending, businesses now, if they just look at their own narrow self-interest and don't look at the big picture, they're going to, you know, restrict investment, they're going to lay people off, cut wages. Oh, but now the workers aren't getting paid, and now there's more fear because unemployment went up, so consumers are going to tighten up even more, and then you're just going to have this downward spiral. And so Hoover thought, we're going to nip this thing in the bud, we're going to keep workers' wages the same, and so they're still going to have that purchasing power to keep buying the product. And so we'll stop, you know, we'll arrest this fall in spending and demand, and we'll stop this recession in its tracks. All right. So that's not, and you can see I included a quote here from in a union publication. It was called the American Federationist from early 1930. To show you that this isn't just Hoover after the fact spinning things. The labor leaders at the time thought Herbert Hoover was progressive. That, oh, at least now we got somebody who's not just going to rely on this dog-eat-dog, cutthroat competition of capitalism, that he's going to prop up wages. Now, there's some dispute about how did Hoover get businesses to keep their wages high? Like, was it just him wagging his finger at them, or did he do something behind the scenes? And we can get into that later. But what is not in dispute is that nominal wages were far stickier in the 30s than they had been in 1920 and 21. In 1920 and 21, prices fell and wages fell, nominal wages fell even more. Whereas in the 30s, prices collapsed and nominal wages did not fall nearly as much, so that real wages were increasing. So if you kept your job, you actually were getting a real pay increase as the Depression wore on, which is odd. All right, so to try to understand why is it that unemployment went up so much, a lot of economists are going to say it's because the real price of labor kept going up at the same time the productivity of labor was going down. So, of course, businesses are going to hire less labor. Okay, last thing, and then I'll turn over to your questions, is Andrew Mellon and liquidation. There is a famous passage from Hoover's memoirs. And I said this before, but I just want to repeat it. If we had more time here, I would read it to you. But Hoover says, you know, after the 29 crash, there were two schools of thought in my administration. The one, represented by the Treasury Secretary Mellon, recommended that we do nothing. And Mellon, and then now Hoover in his memoirs is putting quotation marks and saying, this is what Andrew Mellon told all of us at this meeting. You know, we were kind of having a huddle, like, what are we going to do? The stock market just fell more than it ever had in U.S. history. We got to do something. And Mellon was saying, we don't do anything. Let the market find its own natural bottom. And he was alluding back to a bad depression in the 1800s when Mellon said things were fine. Prices crashed. People got laid off, but then they found new jobs. Let the market find its own natural bottom, and then it'll grow again. And he famously said, you know, we need to liquidate stocks, liquidate labor, liquidate real estate, something like that. So a lot of people now, including Brad DeLong, will say things like, Herbert Hoover was an Austerian. Let me quote from his Treasury Secretary, and they'll read that passage. And if that's all you ever heard, you would say, oh, my gosh, I can't believe how hard-hearted people were back in the early 30s. Man, that Herbert Hoover was a monster. But Hoover explicitly disavows what Mellon said. You don't even have to turn the page, at least in the volume that I have. It's on the left-hand side, Hoover's quoting Mellon, and then the right-hand side, he says, but we didn't do that. I pointed out to Mellon that times were different. The U.S. economy was much different from how it had been back in the 1800s in that episode that you're talking about. All right, so the point of Hoover quoting Mellon is to say to the reader, I didn't listen to that crazy guy. Aren't you glad I was in office? I was the president, and I did all of these progressive measures so the federal government could help. So you can argue, one can argue Hoover didn't do enough, but you certainly can't use that Mellon quote to prove how bad Hoover was. I mean, that's, anyway, I just need to calm down about that. Okay, turn it over now. We've got about 5 minutes for your questions. C.R. Ellsworth says, where does the term wage inflation fit into Austrian economics? I don't know that Austrians, I mean, if they would use the term, I guess they would just mean the wages were going up. So I think they would mean nominal increase in wages. But I think a lot of other economists by that, they mean things like a wage price spiral. And that if you're trying to understand why our price is going up, it might be because wages are going up and therefore, you know, businesses have to, you know, so if labor unions can get for themselves wage increases, nominal wage increases, then the businesses are going to just pass that along to the consumer. And so in some cases you can see rising prices, consumer prices, and you might say, oh, that's due to the fact that the labor unions got higher wages. So if that's what one means by the term, then I think most Austrians wouldn't endorse that causal mechanism. Okay, Gary Pagan says, what could cause a decline in consumption and capital investment in an ultra-low interest rate environment caused by central bank intervention in the money markets? Gary, are you saying, like, what is Lionel Robbins talking about? Is that what the impetus for your question is? I'm not sure what the context is. Anyway, I'm going to assume that's what you're talking about. What Robbins was getting at there is the reason there's a crisis is that people realize a lot of businesses should not have been doing what they were doing, and then in particular a lot of financial institutions made investments that now turn sour. And a lot of banks also now made investments that look like they're going to not turn out well. And so if you had lent your money to those banks or deposited your money to those banks, now you're terrified and you're going to rush the bank to get your money out. This is before governments insured commercial bank deposits, right? So in that environment, so all of this is driven by the fact that there were genuine malinvestments. The economy had lines of investment projects going that should not have been going. And so Robin's point is, how do you fix that? What's the solution to that? Well, you got to shut down those things that shouldn't be going and then take their resources and put them elsewhere. You know, the workers who are in this factory that shouldn't be operating, they need to all get laid off, and then one by one they're going to get absorbed elsewhere in the production structure. And the steel and oil and gasoline, whatever is being used in that factory, need to stop being consumed in that process because that's not a good use of those things, and they need to get sold on the open market to the highest bidder, you know, after a bankruptcy proceeding, and then get reabsorbed elsewhere. And so how do you make that quick and painless, or not painless, but get it over with so it's not too painful, is you let interest rates rise to signify the true scarcity now of liquid funds. And that high interest rate, the enterprises that really are insolvent, they're just going to go under, which is what you want to have happen. But if now the central banks come in and flood the market with cheap credit, and they actually go out of their way to try to prop up teetering enterprises, all you're doing is continuing the unsustainable boom. You're allowing these enterprises to continue limping along so workers keep showing up at them every day, even though those workers shouldn't be there. They should be going elsewhere. They shouldn't keep going to that factory. That's not a good use of resources. So that's what he's saying, that's why this slump just kept going on and on and on. Whereas historically, classically, yeah, there were panics and depressions with a small d, but they would be sharp and quick. There'd be a boom, prices would crash, wages would crash, unemployment would shoot up, but then it would come right back down. And then within a year or two, you'd have an expansion again. Whereas for some reason, after the 29 crash, it was awful in 30. It was awful in 31. It was awful in 32. It was awful in 33. It's just like, how come the economy's not getting any better? And Robbins is saying, well, it's because, among other reasons, the central banks are going out of their way to prop up losers. If they're not having the sharp purge, it's not, you know, like ripping the Band-Aid off and just getting it over with. Instead, they're taking the Band-Aid and going, and it's like, for 4 years in a row. Okay, I got to stop there, guys, because we're over time. You guys have a lot of good questions in the Q&A. Bill, I see you talking about the gold cover. It did restrain the Fed, but the legislation changed it in the mid-30s. And let me – I don't want to say anything off the top of my head because I'm going to botch the details. But I will – your question, Bill Cerubi, and everybody else's that's below yours in the Q&A, I'll get that, and, you know, I'll type them up and post them in the Moodle and send, blast out an email for that. Okay, thanks for tuning in, everybody, and I will you've got the email for me about when the office hours are tomorrow, and I'll also, by tomorrow, post quiz 2, so we'll be getting back on a rhythm, and then later next week I'll post quiz 3, and then we'll be totally back on schedule.